Deborah Heath is with me again to talk about a book, an audiobook, Midwich Cuckoos by John Wyndham. Now, John Wyndham was writing in the 1950s, thereabouts.
He started before that. He was brought up in quite a privileged family and wrote because he didn't have to earn an income. Eventually he did, so I think he started just before the war, and he did a few books with his real surname, which wasn't Wyndham, it was something else. Wyndham was one of his middle names, and he messed around with all five or six of his names. And then he had a very interesting Second World War, which I'm sure has affected his writing. He was involved in cracking ciphers, and was also, strangely, in the Home Guard. He was a fire watcher, and eventually he did go into the forces. When the war finished, his brother had started to be quite a prolific writer, and I suppose he felt a bit jealous, so he thought he would change his style. So the books we associate with him, certainly under this name, tend to be science fiction.
The title, The Midwich Cuckoos, has got two key words to it. Midwich, which is the name of the place,
yes,
which is a village, and that's where the story starts,
yes,
in and around that village, and it's all about that, what becomes the Midwich Day Out.
Yes.
A day that disappears from the calendar. And the cuckoos is because it takes the idea of what the cuckoo actually does, which is get into somebody else's nest and lay its egg, and that egg has a dramatic effect on the rest of the eggs in that nest.
Yes, so it takes over. It hatches before the mother bird's real eggs, and it demands much more of her attention and often pushes the other eggs and birds out of the nest. That's very relevant to the story.
Now, we're sort of teasing, we're playing around with this, but before we get into the plot itself, there's a lot of narration in this, isn't there? There's a lot of talk by the author, if you like, or by his principal character, his narrator.
It's interesting, and I think we should touch on that a bit later when we're sort of summarising the book. But let's talk about the role of the narrator. It's quite an interesting one because the narrator doesn't really take part in the story. He lives in Midwich, but has taken a day off. So he comes back and says at the beginning that he's collected people's memories. They might not be quite in the right order, but he is basically a reporter. He reports back to us. And although he is present during some of the strange things that go on, he is very much an outsider.
The story really begins with him and his wife. They were out for the day. They came back to their village, Midwich, but couldn't get through.
What happened was that everyone was carrying on their normal business, and then suddenly everything stopped.
From 10:17 that night, information about Midwich becomes episodic. Its telephones remained dead. The bus that should have passed through it failed to reach Stouch, and a truck that went to look for the bus did not return. A notification from the RAF was received in train of some unidentified flying object. Not, repeat not, a service machine, detected by radar in the Midwich area, possibly making a forced landing. Someone in Opley reported a house on fire in Midwich, with apparently nothing being done about it. The train fire appliance turned out and thereafter failed to make any reports. The train police dispatched a car to find out what had happened to the fire engine, and that too vanished into silence. Opley reported a second fire, and still seemingly nothing being done. Constable Gobby in Stouch was rung up and sent off on his bicycle to Midwich, and no more was heard of him either.
People were on the telephone and suddenly everything went dead. People were on a bus and the driver stopped driving and everyone froze.
There were people who died as a result of this, what we call the day out, and we'll come to explain it more as we go through, a day when something happened. And therefore the police first, I guess, and then the army.
Yeah, so it all becomes a little bit top secret, doesn't it? And I must say I lost track of which government agencies were involved. But nevertheless, they had some very clever scientists and military officials in to come and see what had happened. And what they worked out was that it was not only sort of the ground level of Midwich that had been affected, but also the height. So they sent an aeroplane up to do investigations, and it didn't end very well for the people in that aeroplane. So think of it in effect like a sort of a dome where inside everything stopped. So they did a few experiments, including, I felt very sorry for the canary in a cage, but they found a canary.
He lowered his pole from the vertical, and with the cage still dangling at its end, thrust it forward tentatively. The bird fell off its perch and lay on the sanded floor of the cage. The corporal withdrew the cage. The bird gave a slightly indignant tweet and hopped back on its perch. One watching private stepped forward with his bucket and daubed a little whitewash on the grass. The other made a mark on his map. The party then moved along a dozen yards or so and repeated the performance.
They couldn't see it, they couldn't smell it, they couldn't feel it.
Yes.
But there was this dome of something. And in fact, the narrator and his wife both tried to avoid the police blockage and the army blockage by going across the fields, and they consecutively collapse into sleep. When they're brought back out, memorably by a pole with a boat hook on the end, as it were, by somebody, pulls them back up, they wake up again. So it's not fatal. Whatever this is not fatal.
But people are very confused about it. Eventually, the effects wear off, and it seems that everything returns to normal in Midwich. It's just referred to colloquially as the day out, and everybody carries on with their business as if nothing had happened. And I think the government have done quite a good job of covering it up and keeping it hush-hush.
Because there is a mysterious ministry building inside that village.
Yes, the Grange.
I think it was the Grange.
The Grange,
taken
that's
over
right.
by a ministry for research. We never really get
no,
to the bottom
we
of
don't,
this.
We don't
know what's going on there. Anyway, so the Grange is there, something's going on, but as you say, the police, the authorities keep it very quiet. You don't get a lot of media reporting on it. It's really quite covered up. And then something happens a bit later.
After a few weeks, maybe a couple of months, the women of Midwich, well, a lot of the women, start to notice some changes, namely that they appear to be pregnant. The strange thing about this is that some of them have had no means of getting pregnant, and it's all a little bit of a surprise.
Farrellyn ate some cornflakes, drank some coffee, and accepted a fried egg and bacon. After two nibbles, she pushed the plate away decisively enough to arouse Angela from her reflections. "What's the matter?" Angela inquired from her end of the table. "Isn't it fresh?" "Oh, there's nothing wrong with it," Farrellyn told her. "I just don't happen to feel eggy this morning, that's all." Angela seemed uninterested. When one had half hoped she would ask why... An inside voice seemed to prompt Farrellyn. Why not now? After all, it can't really make much difference when, can it? So she took a breath. By way of introducing the matter gently, she said, As a matter of fact, Angela, I was sick this morning. Oh? Indeed, said her stepmother, and paused while she helped herself to butter. In the act of raising her marmaladed toast, she added, So was I. Horrid, isn't it?
It's all the women who are of childbearing age, isn't
exactly.
it? So if they were older than that, they weren't affected. If they were younger than that, they weren't affected. It's all the women who were in a position where, because of their age and their health and whatever else, were able to become pregnant.
Yes. So we have some teenagers and we have some older maiden ladies. Oh, very shocking indeed for those maiden ladies. And they go and see the vicar about it. And eventually all the bigwigs of the town, including the vicar, the doctor and Zellaby himself, he's an academic, moral philosophy or something. I'm not quite sure.
And it's his daughter and his wife. Angela is the second or third wife, I can't remember which, but his daughter, Farrellyn, that we're talking earlier.
Yes.
So this is the husband. He's older than his wife.
Yes.
He's, as you say, an academic. He gets very interested in the detail of this and has a lot to say about various things. Mm. And he lives in the other big house in the village, I think that's...
That's right. So the bigwigs get together and Angela leads a talk for all the women who are affected, and she's basically saying, you know, we've got to get through it together. We don't know what's going on. It's all a bit strange, but we need to keep it quiet, keep our heads down, and not tell anyone outside of Midwich. And so they continue in their pregnancies. They're obviously very worried, but they do some form of scan. I think they're talking about x-rays. It seems very dangerous to give x-rays to pregnant women now, doesn't it? But they can tell that the babies are developing normally and seem to be large and healthy. And eventually these babies are born and seem to be absolutely perfect, apart from a slightly strange thing that they all have golden eyes.
They're all growing at the same age. I mean, they've all started at the same time, on the same day, the Midwich day out. I think, as far as I remember, not all of them survive the pregnancy.
Yes.
There are a few fatalities.
A bit later, when they were a couple of months old, there was some influenza in the village and some of them died, including Farrellyn's child. But the interesting thing is that as these children develop, they develop much more quickly than one would expect. So we're left with infants, really, who have the mental processes of a 4 or 5 year old. Zellaby is very quick to notice this and conducts a few experiments. So Zellaby gathers some important people, including the narrator and his wife, and shows them something very interesting. One by one, he approaches some of the girls and boys separately. So starting with a boy, he teaches it a trick, how to get a barley sugar out of a box, quite an intricate box. Then he goes to the next boy. But this boy doesn't have to learn how to do it like the first boy. He just instinctively does it, even though he's only about 1 or 2 years old. Then he goes to a girl. The first girl has to learn how to perform the trick as well. The second girl instinctively knows how to do it.
Mr. Zellerby, are you claiming that if I were to tell anything to any one of the boys, all the rest would know it?
Certainly. Provided, of course, that it was something simple enough for them to understand at this stage.
Janet looked highly sceptical. Zellerby sighed.
The old trouble, he said. Lynch Darwin and you show the impossibility of evolution. But, as I said, you've only to apply your own tests.
And what he concludes is that there is a collective individualism. Specifically, there is one male identity and one female identity, which is really very curious.
We don't have here one single group en rapport. We have two separate groups of rapport, apparently without cross-connections. Now, if that is so, and we have seen that it is, a question that immediately presents itself is this. To what extent is any of these children an individual? Each is physically an individual, as we can see, but is he so in other ways? If he is sharing consciousness with the rest of the group instead of having to communicate with others with difficulty, as we do, can he be said to have a mind of his own, a separate personality, as we understand it? I don't see that he can.
And as you say, they are older than their years all the way through. They appear to be growing at a faster rate. Both physically and intellectually?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So they're very large, they're very strong. And eventually, this creeps everyone out so much that all the children are encouraged, or actually I think they choose, to go and live at the Grange. It's interesting to note that the children don't want to leave Midwich. So sometimes the parents will try to take them out in the car. But there's just some sort of strange force that always brings them back again. So they have to live in the village. And eventually, Angela escapes, leaving her child behind. So the children are eventually living at the Grange together.
Now, there's a limit to how far we can go. And the tricky thing about this is that almost anything we say beyond this point is going to give the plot away.
Yes.
Because these kids have got a certain sort of characteristics and certain sort of natures which become more and more relevant to the story.
Yes.
And they dictate what happens.
Yes. So we want to leave it at a place where things are intriguing. It is very intriguing. And you want to read on. So I think this is the place to stop discussing the plot.
I mean, it does roll along. I felt at first when I was reading it thinking, this feels like a 1950s movie, which is an odd thing to think. It has that sort of pedanticism of the narration falling on and forward and forward and forward. And you think, oh, come on, start jumping corners, because, you know, nowadays we don't have that level of continuous narration.
That's right. And it was referred to by someone as a cosy catastrophe. That's absolutely what it is. It is cosy. It does feel 1950s, but it's certainly a catastrophe. There are quite a few deaths in this book. It's quite a horrible book. And yet you feel quite comforted by it at the same time.
And in fact, I quite enjoyed it because it had that, there was a coziness about it. I think there's various levels under this. I think that some of the other writers later have brought this out. So there's a sort of moral issues being raised here. There's an illustration I'd love to give about this, but I can't because that would give away the half the plot. But there are things you think, okay, then this author is actually trying to say more than just tell a story. I enjoyed it as a storytelling.
Yeah.
I got a little bit irritated by it at times.
Yes.
Because it's a bit of, I'd like to explain this to you again slowly. Is that what I mean by narration?
Yeah, he just goes off on a tangent, doesn't he?
It is because nature is ruthless, hideous and cruel beyond belief that it was necessary to invent civilization. One thinks of wild animals as savage, but the fiercest of them begins to look almost domesticated when one considers the viciousness required of a survivor in the sea. As for the insects, their lives are sustained only by intricate process of fantastic horror. There is no conception more fallacious than the sense of coziness implied by Mother Nature. Each species must strive to survive, and that it will do, by every means in its power, however foul. Unless the instinct to survive is weakened by conflict with another instinct.
Angela seized the pause to put in, with a touch of impatience, I've no doubt you're gradually working round to something, Gordon.
Yes, Zellerby owned. I'm working round again to cuckoos. Cuckoos are very determined survivors, so determined that there is really only one thing to be done with them, once one's nest is infested. I am, as you know, a humane man. I think I may even say a kindly man by disposition.
You may, Gordon.
As a further disadvantage, I am a civilized man. For these reasons, I shall not be able to bring myself to approve of what ought to be done, nor even when we perceive its advisability with the rest of us. So like the poor hen thrush, we shall feed and nurture the monster and betray our own species.
This is typical, really, of Zellerby. He goes off on one. He's an academic. He is possibly John Wyndham's mouthpiece.
Although Wyndham's uses somebody else as his narrator,
yeah.
He's actually got two narrators in
there.
He has, sense,
he? Yeah. He's exploring ideas. He's playing devil's advocate. And in fact, the narrator's wife, Janet, approaches him from another point of view altogether. So she really challenges Zellerby. So they're all very scientific in their way. What I've concluded, having read the book now twice and watched the film, is this is a cracking story, but it's not a great book. It starts off, probably the first half is really good. It rolls along. It's very engaging. But like you, I got frustrated at some of the asides. But I do think it's worth reading because the story is so good and because it does give a lot of opportunity for discussion with other people who've read it. So when I finished it, I wanted you to read it. I wanted my husband to read it. I just wanted to discuss it with someone. It's a very, very good story with some interesting things to say.
And it certainly develops the characters. You know who these people, you can visualise these people. That's why I said
absolutely.
It felt like a 1950s film, because I could see them
me too.
Through the text, which is quite clever to do, I think, for a writer, because you're not just stuck in the words, where you can actually visualise it very easily.
So you read it in book form?
I read it in book form.
Okay, so of course I had to listen to it because of my eyesight issues, and it's read by Nathaniel Parker. It's absolutely brilliant. I have some issues with audiobooks because people like me are forced to listen to them because we can't read ourselves. But often what you're getting is the interpretation of the narrator. So you can never come to it completely cold, really. You've always got someone else's ideas there. At times, that is very frustrating. Nathaniel Parker here reads in such an animated fashion, and yet you kind of don't notice him reading it. And that's absolutely how it should be. He gets into each character, he paints a picture, and I think this is a really good example of a very talented audiobook narrator. So I enjoyed something that I wasn't expecting to enjoy.
Good. Well, we're talking about the book, The Midwich Cuckoos, and about the cuckoos themselves, these kids who are born with these golden eyes and the blonde hair and powers that we learn more and more about as we go on. It's narrated, as you said, by Nathaniel Parker. It lasts for approximately 6.5 hours, so it's not a huge listen, which is good. Thank you very much, Debbie, for talking about that book.
You're welcome.
And our thanks go, as ever, to Caliber Audio for providing us with a CD from which we could take those extracts.